Hey, patrons. This is a recording that Bryce and I did as a bonus to his patrons after I was on episode 138 of the Naked Mormonism podcast. If you haven't heard that recording, you should. Although you're patrons of the show, you've listened to that by now. It was a lot of fun. The question that I was really called upon to answer was involving a federal court's decision whether to extradite Joseph Smith from Illinois back to Missouri to stand charges for attempting to assassinate the former governor of Missouri. Incredibly interesting. And it involves trying to read one of these early 19th century cases, which is always a challenge for me because I'm not 200 years old. And so Bryce and I got on to talk about reading old cases and stuff. And as happens with Bryce and I, we wound up wandering way far afield. We talked about all sorts of stuff, including, as I promised on the main feed, the definition of the apex of Yodel Mountain. I'm really, really excited about this. I as soon as we did the recording, I asked Bryce if I could share this out with you guys, as well as having him share it out. And he very graciously agreed to do that. So if you haven't gone over and listened to Naked Mormonism, that, you know, Bryce did us a solid here, and let's see if we can't repay his kindness a little bit. And listen to the episode. Let me know what you think about it. I had a lot of fun, and I thought it was really interesting. So I hope you enjoy.
All right, so listeners are going to have to excuse me. There is a dog that is excitedly playing around me. You're going to hear some background noise today. And Andrew, we may even hear Andrew's dog as well. But of course, I want to welcome back Andrew Torres of Opening Arguments and the Law Offices of P. Andrew Torres. Andrew, thanks again for joining us and talking for a few minutes.
Thank you, Bryce. And two things. Number one, listeners, it's my fault. I insisted that Bryce have a puppy present while we record. it's just part of my kid. I'm sorry. I'm kind of a prima donna. And I was like, if you're going to have me come on and do a patron special, we got to have a puppy in the background. And number two, I think Bryce should have to post pictures to Patreon of the puppy. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I can definitely make that happen. And if listeners aren't listeners to Opening Arguments, you know that it is a heated debate about cats versus dogs, because Thomas is a cat person, and Andrew, as we know, has the most delightful little puppy dog that we once in a while hear come through on the show.
Thomas is not just a cat person, right? Like, Thomas
he's like an anti-dog person.
Oh, well, yeah, we have
it's offensive.
Too. But he is a crazy cat lady, right? Like, he is that, like, homeless woman from The Simpsons that can, like, reach into her gown and, like, throw a cat at you wherever
he has.
I'm not making this up. I think it's 17 cats in his house. Like, it's but I use the facetious bit there, but he seriously has five cats in his house, right?
Like, wow.
I'm not.
That's incredible.
It's why, you know, you start with the big number, then you're like, oh yeah, he's just saying that because he has two cats. No, the man has five cats. Like,
that's too much.
No.
See, cats are kind of like kids, right? If you have like one or two cats, you can give them all your love, all your attention, but the more cats you have, the less resources, love, and attention you're giving to each one, and it becomes irresponsible.
Hi,
on,
Mormon
Thomas.
Listeners. Like, what percentage of your audience has five or more kids? Like, it's got to be a fairly...
It has to be at least a couple points
worth.
Yeah,
notable percentage of your audience. Anyway, yeah. All right. No, enough banter back and forth.
So, yeah, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about 19th century American law, because you said that you had a lot of fun diving into the court documents, and at the end of when I had you on the episode 138, you were like saying not real words, of course. They were definitely not real words, and saying that those are 19th century American law terms. I'm like, no, come on. So what strikes you about 19th century American law?
Okay, so here's the thing, right? The way in which we practice law today is almost incomprehensible in comparison to the way in which law was practiced from the 19th century and before, right? And basically,
we no longer have like roving bands of lawyers that just like camp out and don't actually have anywhere they call home.
So this is right. This is something I try and drive home on my show every episode. But the law has been trending in a direction kind of away from crazy technicalities, right? Away from, oh, well, if you haven't done the like national treasure kind of like put this in this order and that, you know, to unlock the key that goes here, right? Like a very long time, that's what the law was like, right? And I think today people still have this view of, you know, the legal system as being this, you know, kind of indecipherable Harry Potter-esque minefield where you have to get the exact Latin words right. And if you don't, then, you know, you go home. And it's not, it's 100%.
And if you combine the words exactly right, then you don't have to pay taxes.
Right. Yeah. but it's 100% not the case now. Right. Like you've seen my speech in which I say, like, you know, you can file a complaint on a napkin, you know, written in crayon where you spell every other word like Eli Bosnick on crack. And like the court will
kind of like Larry Klayman.
Yes. Yeah. We'll date stamp and file your napkin. Right. Like that there's no longer a high bar to participation in the legal system, which is an unqualified good thing. But when you start reading these 19th and 18th century cases, it's like, even as a practicing lawyer, right, as somebody who's read a lot of these things, they're hard to read, right? Like, because they use terminology that we don't use anymore. So what comes to mind, like, I want to tell a story about our next president, Elizabeth Warren, right?
Yes, so, please do.
Elizabeth Warren taught torts at Harvard Law School. And she was well known, particularly once the internet came around, for establishing her alpha dog credentials on day one of class, right? So the way it works in law school is that you get your assignments before day one starts, right? Like there's no like day one, you come in and you look at the syllabus and, you know, like you are expected to have read like a half dozen cases for each class before you get in there. Now, you may be asking yourself, but this is day one of law school. You don't know anything. That's exactly right.
I mean, but it still sounds reasonable. At least like read the case files, like, so you know what you're looking at when you get there and they start talking about law stuffs on the first day, right?
Right. But you have no idea how to read cases, right? So, or at least like I didn't.
They don't know the Andrew Torres method of scrolling to the bottom. And
that's for complaints. But seriously, you know, yeah, like a lot of law students, I guess, come from families in which they have lawyers. So maybe, you know, you have some background. I certainly didn't, right? Like my parents dropped out of community college, right? Like I do not have lawyers anywhere, you know, in my immediate family tree. So Elizabeth Warren used to do this. I think it rises to the level of kind of cruelty, but so here's what she would do. she would assign a half dozen cases that you had to read. And one of them, a bunch of them were probably old cases. They're all kind of foundational cases. And so one of them would be from like 1815. And the case was about resolving a civil debt, right? And you would read the thing and you would come away with kind of a general sense of, okay, like here's how this case came out. You would go into her class and sit down and she would randomly, like there's no raising your hands thing. She would pick a person off the seating chart and say, all right, Mr. Torres, what's a sumpsit? And every year, right, you would, on the first day of class, like the poor, unfortunate soul who got called on would look sort of blankly up at Elizabeth Warren and go, I don't know. And then she would say, well, did you read Smith versus Doe? Yes, I did. Well, can you turn to Smith versus Doe in your case book? Yeah. What's the first line of the opinion? And then you would sheepishly say, this is an action in a sumpsit.
Right.
And then she would repeat the question. Okay, so what's a sumpsit? And you'd have to kind of stumble around and try and figure it out from context. I relate the story, number one, because one of my childhood friends was, in fact, that victim. I was too late to have Liz Warren as a professor. But my friend Keith, childhood friend, got the dubious honor of being called on. And then for, I think, the rest of his life, he's now a senior partner at a major D.C. law firm. But all of his online handles are a Sumpsit guy. Yeah. So all of his online handles are a Sumpsit guy.
That's delightful.
Yep.
So needless to say, it's an occurrence that kind of burned itself into his mind.
Yeah, it leaves a lasting impression. And the reason and Liz Warren does this for two reasons, right? Like, number one, you know, to sort of establish dominance in the room. But number two, to illustrate the difference between the way in which cases are written now and the way in which they were written 150 years ago. And what happens is, in the civil system, there used to be something called the forms of action. Okay. What the forms of action mean is, so an action is filing a lawsuit, right? And the forms of action were the specific boxes that you had to check when you sued somebody, right? And I don't mean literally checking the box, but like, you had to, if you sued somebody for a thing, you not only had to be right, but you had to call it the right thing. And if you called it the wrong thing, the court would say, OK, we totally agree with you on the facts, but you called it this wrong thing. So go back to start and try again. Right.
Really?
And sometimes they would bar you from it. Yes.
I mean, that seems like a way to mitigate people, you know, acting pro se for themselves.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Because you have to have some kind of foundational knowledge in order to even navigate the system and use the right terminology. So I do kind of see a certain, you know, odd utility to that, the same way that I see an odd utility to only, you know, educated landowners can vote, right? It's kind of wrong foundationally, but there are, like, it's capturing an idea that does seem to have some kind of merit.
Yes. But right, that merit, in my view, is, you know, very anti-democratic and
absolutely,
you know, designed to entrench lawyers as these, you know, sort of indecipherable gatekeepers to making the law do stuff for people.
Mm-hmm.
So a Sumpsit, the reason why it was so hard to define a Sumpsit, right, is because a Sumpsit was one of these forms of action. And Bryce, if I were to say, this is an action for a breach of contract, right? A breach is kind of a technical term, but you get what that is, right?
Absolutely.
Like, yeah. We have a contract. You broke it. So I want
There's
to be paid
some contract,
right?
Yeah.
Under the forms of action, if you had a breach of contract action, you had to tell the court with one of these magic words what kind of breach of contract action you wanted it to take up, right? So, for example, you could file a breach of contract action for an account, right? You could file it under, I'm sure I'm going to get this wrong because, again, I don't practice law in the 19th century.
You don't have the mutton chops.
Yeah. So there are all sorts of differences. So in other words, if you filed a breach of contract action in one area, it would be only for the precise sum that you had to state in advance, right? What we now call liquidated damages, right? So I would say, okay, I am filing this action, and I want you to pay me $11,205.16, right? And then it would be for the court or the jury, if it was a jury action, to determine if I owed you that or you owed me that precise sum. And so if they discovered that you owed me $3,000, they would be prohibited from awarding $3,000 on, say, an account stated, right? Like they could
because
either
the initial account was for $11,207.16 or whatever you said.
That's exactly right. They can only, it's just a binary thing. If you don't know how much the debt is, right, you would bring an action for assumption, right?
Okay.
And so then you would go in and the jury would be able to determine exactly how much on the breach of contract they owed you, right? So that's crazy, right?
Absolutely.
And there are, and this is the easiest thing, right? This is day one of law school, right? Like this is the easiest example of how the words go out, right? I don't even, like, I could talk to you about the difference between Trover and conversion and replevin and debt and you, but actually I can't because I don't know, like, the precise definitions of all that.
Yeah,
again,
the technical definition.
I don't have to because I don't have mutton chops on, right? But but the important thing is, right, that eventually we got together and we abolished all of this stuff. But we didn't abolish this until the 1930s.
Wow.
When lawyers got together and created the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. And rule number one, not particularly important to get through.
What was, specifically in the 1930s, what was happening in the legal sphere that caused this? Was this coming off of the Great Depression?
It's absolutely consistent with the New Deal, right? So you have these sort of socialist rumblings throughout the United States. You have kind of this general sense of, hey, the U.S. legal system that seems to be highly responsive to rich white property owners is changing. And all of a sudden, you know, we don't have a nation that in which the only thing people care about are rich male white property owners. Right. And the Supreme Court at the time, this is exactly coincident with an era that until now is considered the darkest time in our nation's history from the Supreme Court. It's called the Lochner era. Right. And it stems from a case, Lochner versus New York, but it's bracketed on either side. It's 30 or 40 years in which the Supreme Court repeatedly struck down any kind of effort to ameliorate working conditions. The Lochner case was about overtime in New York bakeries, right?
Okay.
Struck down overtime.
Breaking the unions.
Yep.
Breaking,
this is even, pre-union, but right. Like it struck down any effort to legislate working conditions as violating the freedom of contract of businesses, which was protected by the Fifth Amendment. So, in other words, the Supreme Court, far from being an instrument of protecting individual rights, which is kind of the view that we have today, which is, again, directly left over from the Warren Court of the 1960s and 1970s, with exceptions, right? Like I'm painting with a broad brush here. But but the Lochner era court was highly protective of business rights and very dismissive of legislative efforts to try and protect individuals. That changed with the election of FDR, his threats to pack the Supreme Court, and there was kind of a sea change in how we viewed the law in the 1930s. And, you know,
I wonder, maybe you could very briefly speak on just the overall impact of Eisenhower and FDR on the general sphere of law and politics, because I feel like we could really use another Eisenhower or another FDR today, just considering the grand scheme of things. Am I crazy in saying something like that? A 21st century version of those guys.
Yeah, I don't think that's crazy at all. This is part of my ongoing thesis about jurisprudence, right, is to point out from a historical basis that, you know, when I say, when I describe the state of the Supreme Court right now and the direction in which it is headed, I did this in my debate with Justin Walker, but I'll repeat it again here. I began mm-hmm. with the quote from Groundhog Day, where when Bill Murray is at his most nihilistic as a weatherman, and he goes on the air and he's like, it's going to be cold. It's going to be gray, and it's going to last you the rest of your
rest
life.
Of your life.
Fantastic movie. Yep. And I'm 100% serious about that, right? Like, we have had times in our nation's history, two of them, to be precise, in which for decades the Supreme Court was and the judiciary was weaponized by a political branch to the consternation of the overwhelming majority of the United States. Right. It happened at our nation's founding. Right. Because the first two presidents were members of the capital F Federalist Party, which dissolved soon thereafter. But you know what? Yeah. Like one of the fun things that happens is when your party passes the first Judiciary Act and you get to appoint all the judges,
you kind of set the stage for their entire lives from that point forward.
That is exactly right. And for 30 years, the judiciary was pro-federalist, even though there was not a Federalist Party active in American politics. From 1890 to the late 1930s, right, for a long, long time, again, punctuated with some decisions that I want to talk about. But the overwhelming directionality of the Supreme Court was anti-individual and pro-big business. And so when I say, when you look at what the Supreme Court is doing right now, right, and everybody, right, if you are even a casual follower of the news, you are aware of, you know, the decisions coming out of the Supreme Court right now, which are recognizing corporate rights in a situation where they have never been recognized before, right? And the classic example that I think is really salient, you know, for your listeners, for my listeners, is the Trinity Lutheran decision, right? That was the was from last Supreme Court at last 2017 fall term, and in it the
and,
Supreme
and
Court
listeners,
said, yeah.
I mean, when this came out, you covered it extensively with Andrew Seidel on Opening Arguments and on Serious Inquiries Only, and then you went on Scathing Atheist and talked about it because this is a big case. This is important.
Yeah. This is a totally shut, open and shut, straightforward case, but for the fact that we have an activist right-wing Supreme Court, right? It was...
Yes, and they require a fair and neutral consideration of a person's beliefs.
Well, but it's worse than that because you put in what would have been the key words, right, which is a person's beliefs, right? So let's... We're way off on rabbit trails, but this is fun, so let's do it. What was his issue there was a Missouri program that provided grants to schools to resurface their playgrounds with mulched rubber tires, right? Because it's environmentally conscious, because it's, say, you know, kids fall down, they hit the rubber. It's better than like when you and I were growing up and you fell down and like you hit the rocks and, you know, you liked it. And the state of Missouri,
quit crying.
Right, made a very, very simple statement, right? They said, if you're a church, you can't apply for the program. You know why? Because these are tax dollars.
You don't pay taxes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We have a limited amount of tax dollars, and if you don't pay taxes, we're not going to let you get the free bonus, right? Like,
but don't worry, you can still call the fire department, and you know, if somebody trespasses on your property, you can still call the police, and you know, you can still use the city sewage system and the city water and and the power. No, you can still use all of those things the tax dollars built, even though you didn't pay any of it.
Right, but limited funds. We're gonna decide where they go, so long as we have a rational basis for deciding where they go. This has always been permissible, right? There was a case in Washington State just a few years earlier. in my view, 100% identical on the facts, which was Washington State had a scholarship fund and they said, you know what, like, we're going to provide these state scholarships, but we're not going to provide them if you're going to take them and go to seminary. Right. We are not going to take limited state funds and use it for sectarian religious beliefs.
It's the same argument against charter schools.
Yep. Yep.
Religious charter schools. Yeah,
right. And absolutely. Again, keep in mind, like, that this is not even asking the question, would it be permissible if they had opened it up to, you know, participation by schools or by seminaries, right? By religious schools or by seminary. Right? This is the question on the lawsuit is, if a majority of the public, if a majority of the legislature decides to make this decision, is it permissible? Right. And the Supreme Court in Trinity Lutheran, for the first time in American history, said it's not fair to make a church choose between having to be a church or having to apply for funds. Right. And I'm reading this and there was not, you know, Andrew Seidel and I talked about this on the show, but there was not enough outrage, in my view. You know, it sort of broke down on the traditional, like, liberal conservative grounds for the point that I made, which was churches don't have rights, right? Churches are a tax-free agglomeration of individuals. Individuals have rights, right? Like,
absolutely.
There's no such thing as a corporate right to be a church. Similarly, in Hobby Lobby, right? Recognize, like, the right of Hobby Lobby as a business to have a religious belief. Businesses don't have religious beliefs, right?
I would argue that there are probably some corporations out there that happen to run churches that would claim that they definitely have rights.
but the Constitution doesn't recognize that.
And so
I bring up those decisions. I could talk about, you know, a dozen
it's,
other
it's
decisions.
We the people, not we the corporations.
Exactly right. And so I think, right, when I think of this Supreme Court as being kind of a new Lochner era, I think that 30 years from now, 40 years from now, we will look back at this era of the Supreme Court and say, this was a weird time in American history in which the Supreme Court decided that artificial institutions had rights under the Constitution. And that persisted until, you know, 2038, in which the Supreme Court ruled blah, 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 blah. I could be wrong on that. But
and there has to be some level of cognitive dissonance that comes into play when we're talking about the founding fathers and this idea of, like, a originalist, capital O, originalist reading of the Constitution, and thinking, you know, did the founding fathers ever think that money is literally votes and that corporations are literally legally people? I mean, you wouldn't think that that's kind of what they were trying to go for when they, you know, initially authored this God-given document, right?
Yeah, well, Bryce, you've managed... Oh, sorry. <All right. laughs> Try and work around puppy barking. I upset her by running in front of her. All right. Come on.
This is a Patreon edition puppy special, puppy law special.
I figured you would, you know, lightly edit this at least, but
I'll do my best.
Do your best.
It's kind of tough, though.
I appreciate it. All right, so I'll pick back up. Well, Bryce, you've managed to poke exactly the hottest of my hot buttons, which is the question of how we interpret provisions in the Constitution and how vacuous the idea of originalism is. I always, whenever somebody tells me they're an originalist, I start with the following couple of questions, right? I'm like, oh, so what we want to do is we want to figure out what the founding fathers meant when they used certain words, right? Yes. Okay. So the Fifth Amendment says no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. What's a process and how much of that are you due?
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And they'll kind of
crafted intentionally vaguely for that reason.
It is that is exactly right. And, you know, I've been on the soapbox, you know, for 3 years now. That's exactly right. Originalism is incoherent at the structural level because it is abundantly clear that, but for a couple of exceptions, which I'll talk about in a second, The founding fathers intended for the language in the Constitution to be wide open, to evolve with the times, and to be subject to the interpretation of the judicial branch, right? And that is why our country, in my view anyway, that is why our country and our Constitution has been stable for 200 plus years in a way that other countries were not, right? Because our Constitution has very few explicit statements. It has some, right? Like, so for example, right?
don't quarter soldiers in my house.
There you go, right?
With my curly white wig on. Yep, yes.
You know some of my greatest hits here, but right. Article 2 says the president must be 35, right? So there are zero Supreme Court cases. There are zero cases of any kind that are called upon to interpret that clause, right? Because we know what it means to say the president must be 35, right? Like,
can we make a constitutional amendment to put a top limiter on that as well?
yeah, the president must not eat McDonald's 3 times a week.
Jesus,
that would exclude us having President Thomas Smith. So I don't know that I want to do that, but we'll come up with something.
The president must not be able to serve McDonald's at an official White House function.
Yeah. But
hamburgers.
I love that. I just did this gag on OA, but I'll repeat it here because it's good. Like, I think it was Jimmy Fallon who was like, the U and the E aren't anywhere near each other on the keyboard, right?
Right.
Even the D and the G are 2 keys away. Like, this is not a typo, right?
No,
this is somebody who really thinks they're hamburgers.
He floated it out a year ago with Covfefe, and then people went crazy apeshit over it. And of course, it's intentional, but it's just hacky by this point. Come on.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's a really interesting law review article that posits, right, that views what Trump is doing through the lens of, here's somebody who literally the only thing at which he has been successful in his entire stupid life is being a game show host, right? Hosting a reality TV show, right?
Yep. He's getting people to say his name.
He's terrible at real estate. He's terrible at every other thing that he's ever done.
He's terrible at USFL.
I did a long OA on the USFL. So we could go back to that. But the golden rule of reality TV is, right, keep people watching. And I really think, right, so part of the Law Review's thesis is, you know, that every time, right, Trump does one of these idiot tweets that causes those of us on the left to like retweet it out mockingly, like, we're doing his job for him, right?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah, it's intentional. It is so intentional.
So I have stopped. I do not. The OA account does not follow at Real Donald Trump, and I do not retweet out dumb stuff our president says in a slight effort to do that. But anyway, all right. So you and I, like, this is, we got way down a rabbit trail.
Oh, yeah. I don't even, I can't even see the surface anymore.
But it's so much fun. But yeah, but no, that, so go back to originalism. I think that the notion of original intent is incoherent. So always, right, the Supreme Court was meant to be, you look at Federalist 75, it's 100% clear on this, was meant to be the arbiter of what these vague terms mean and their evolution over time, right? Like that has kind of a negative connotation because of the tremendous PR job that right-wing originalists have done over the past 30 years. But that's exactly what our founding fathers envisioned. And I would argue it's part of why the U.S. Constitution stands when virtually every other major democracy from, 1787 onward has undergone massive revisions in the past, 230 plus years. I would argue
see that as a bad thing. Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, a lot of them have often been, incumbent with their, their token bloodshed and revolutionary, revolutions, but I don't want that part of it, but like revising the Constitution every once in a while doesn't seem like the worst idea.
Wow. Boy, I think I feel like we could do a whole episode on that. Here's what I will. Here's what I will say with respect to that. And I have openly said, right, I am small C conservative by temperament when it comes to my theory of jurisprudence, my view on the role of the legal system. Right. I believe that structurally the courts are there. There's the most famous footnote in history. It's a footnote from a decision in the 1910s called Caroline Products, which was about milk. Right. But it's footnote four, which says that the Supreme Court and the judiciary have a special role in protecting the rights of, quote, discrete and insular minorities, end of quote. And I think that is the fundamental animating principle of the separation of powers, right? Like, we know the founding fathers were anti-majoritarian. We could talk at great length about the nature of U.S. history and their distrust of the mob. But fundamentally,
mobocracy.
Yep. Fundamental. I was thinking about your most recent episodes in segment. But fundamentally, the reason you carve out the judiciary and you give them life tenure is that way they are not responsible to a political constituency. That way they can say, hey, 20% of the country is X. And unlike kind of a theory of floating flexible majorities, right? Like the idea behind democracy is that, oh, well, you know, if you always rule in favor of Republicans, like eventually, you know, and Republicans are 52-48, eventually the Democrats will be in power. And so that's why you're not going to structurally disadvantage. I happen to think that argument is bogus, and I think gerrymandering disproves it.
Right.
But the notion of discrete and insular minorities, right, like that there is, right, like Democrats become Republicans, African-Americans do not become white people. Right. Like that's what that means, you know. When you can pick on a minority and say you will always be African-American and therefore like African-Americans will be slaves. Right. Even the founding fathers recognized that was a potential problem. And they created the judiciary and imbued it with independence so as to protect those groups. Right. That's the mission statement of the judiciary. I believe very strongly we are in the process of losing that. And I think it is highly likely we're going to lose that for decades. And people tell me all the time, like, well, okay, what can we do? I, you know, Liz Warren is going to win in 2020. So in 2021, we're going to, and the answer is, you know,
the courts move so much slower than that. They're so much more deliberate and they take lifetimes to overturn.
That's the way they're designed. That is exactly right. It goes back to, you know, what I said half an hour ago, which is if you don't think the courts can be an institution of regressive politics for decades, then you don't know American history. Right. It has happened repeatedly. And look, we're in the midst of that right now. This has taken kind of a darker turn than I had anticipated.
But at least if, you know, if Democrats were able to successfully brand this shutdown we're currently in the middle of as the Trump shutdown, maybe Democrats will successfully be able to label this era of Supreme Court jurisprudence as the Trump era. You got the Lochner era, you got the Dred Scott decision coming out of the era before that, and you got the Trump era.
So we talked about this a little bit on the episode of OA that just dropped as you and I are recording, which is episode 245 in talking about the shutdown. Let me give you the arguments both ways really, really quickly, right? So the first is Trump's approval ratings, Marist tracking poll from before the shutdown till now, are -7. That's when you start crappy, right? And Trump's approval ratings were not good at the start. And so there's not a whole lot of downward movement that's possible. But his approval went from 42 to 39, -3. And the disapproval, I forget the exact number, but the disapproval was up +4, right? I think from 48 to 52, but don't quote me on that part. I know he went from 42 to 39 on the top line. And most critically, that among key Trump constituencies, the numbers are down. He's down among suburban men, which is the key issue, right? That's how Trump won in 2016. He's down among evangelical Christians from 73 to 66.
That's a huge jump. That's because that was always the most, you know, ardent holdout of his supporting group that now they're losing huge chunks.
Those idiots are coming back, right? They will,
yeah,
right?
They always will.
They will. So if you want to be optimistic, the shutdown seems to be very bad politically for Donald Trump. On the flip side of that, we read a letter that I got from a listener on the air, and I'm 100% sympathetic to this position, right? He says, my girlfriend is a non-essential, quote unquote, government employee, and on January 11th, she didn't get a paycheck, and I had to pay our month's bills, and I have $250 in my checking account, and this is, I believe, a direct quote. He said, "I have since gone from being strongly against the wall to wildly indifferent about it," right? And I get that guy's pain, right? Like, he's sitting there going, like, yeah, I sure don't want to spend $5 billion to do this stupid thing because we have a xenophobic moron as our president.
But I got to eat. But I got
to
eat.
But if you tell me we're allocated $5 billion tomorrow and all of a sudden my girlfriend can go back to work and get paid again, I'm all for it. And I get that. And if I were in that guy's shoes and struggling to make ends meet, I'd be for it too. And boy, that is, you know, so it's easy. So the position I take on the air, right, is the Ronald Reagan, like, we don't negotiate with terrorists, right? And there are lots of good reasons from a strategic perspective, from a structural perspective, to say, as a country, we can't just give in. Right. And I believe that politically.
All enemies, foreign and domestic, even when it's our own damn president.
I believe that very strongly. But I could see the tide of public opinion turning. Right. Like, I could see if Donald Trump does not back down. Right. Like, that's his nature. And I could see. Right. The additional advantage he has is that he does not care about human beings. And
yeah.
So
no morals whatsoever. You can do a lot of things. You can make a lot of things happen when you have absolutely no morals or care for any other living being.
As this is stretching on, like, I can see people saying, like, look, I agree Trump started it, but God damn it, Democrats, I want you to just give in. And I want you to give in because I can't meet the bills.
You honestly don't think that right now the Democrats have the political capital to wage an impeachment war?
I don't believe they do right now.
Even amidst this shutdown over this stupid wall that the majority of people are against, you don't think that they have the capital?
I don't. I think you'd be pulling the trigger too early. You need to have, look, like, we have the blueprint for this, and I get it. I say this all the time, you know, the wheels of justice churn slowly.
I know Mueller needs to conclude the investigation to have all of the actual criminal acts, you know, documented and ready to present to actually indict him once he is impeached. But, like, I understand that. I get that. But I feel like if we are talking on the grounds that we have impeached presidents or brought impeachment hearings on presidents before, we crossed that threshold a year and a half ago. Right.
I think that's because you're in your 20s and you live on the West Coast.
That's fair.
Impeachment requires broad-based consensus across the country. And look, we have a blueprint for that, right? We have 11 Republican senators just broke last week to maintain sanctions against Russia, right? Like, broke with the administration, which is a, you know, puppet of the Russian government. And so there are opportunities to pick off Republican senators, and the person that I want you to keep an eye on, and maybe that's how we'll end this totally meandering discussion that began in 1843, but I think it's been fun.
Absolutely.
The person to keep an eye on is Richard Burr of North Carolina. Arch conservative, no friend of mine, no friend of the show. You will not agree with almost anything he's ever done in his entire life. Okay. But I will point out the difference between the House Republican investigation on Russian collusion, which was rubber stamped by the coalition of moron howler monkeys that are in the like far right Tea Party caucus. Right. And it says, oh, well, absolutely. Russia doesn't even know what the United States is. Right. I mean, it was a joke. Right. It was designed to exonerate the president. The difference between that and the Senate Intelligence Committee report, which, again, chaired by Senator Burr, which did not rush to make findings, but kept the investigation open and validated the intelligence reports. Right, because yeah. Richard Burr, I disagree with him on 99% of every, right? If he told me that the sky is blue, right, like I would look up a couple of times, right? Like it I don't agree with him on anything, but fundamentally, I believe that he is in public service because he does not want the United States to become a client state of Russia. Right. He does not want Vladimir Putin interfering and rigging our elections, even if that comes at a cost to his political party. Now, you got to get him to that point. But he's somebody that can be gotten to that point. He is somebody who could have, if he were a Trump loyalist, if he were a blithering moron, if he were, you know, Devin Nunes, he would have shut down the Senate intelligence investigation. He did not. He would have repudiated our nonpartisan intelligence agency reports, which detail at great length the efforts by the Russian government to interfere in our election to benefit Donald Trump. Burr didn't do that. And so that's the person whose eyes, who you should keep your eyes on. And Burr is not remotely there yet. Right. But I think you can get him there. And when you get him there,
okay,
that's when you impeach. Right. That's when
the swing.
That is the apex of Yodel Mountain. So there you go.
Well, yeah, from beginning in the 1800s to the Lochner era to the reformation of legal proceedings to not being so cryptic and allowing people to represent themselves, all the way into current events, all with a background soundtrack of a puppy playing with a ball. This has been quite the wild ride, and it has gone a little bit longer than I expected. You've been very generous with your time. Andrew,
hi, puppy.
Yep, there's Bo. The puppy gave the older dog the ball and then was barking at him because he was holding it.
I have stories. If I did not have a 12:30 call, I would tell you my stories, but I'm sympathetic. I had a 110-pound Bernese Mountain Dog here over the holidays.
Wow.
And little Lily was by far the master of the house. So
I love it.
30 pounds of yapping monster compared to this giant shambling. It looks like a mastodon minus the tusks and the trunk.
Big shaggy carpet, a reanimated pelt. So of course, I want to thank you for coming on, hanging out for a little while. And, you know, this is just for patrons. This is my way of just saying thank you for supporting the show at patreon.com/nakedmormonism. All of you are awesome. And thanks for subscribing to the Patreon feed. Andrew, please take care of yourself out there, man.
I will. Thanks for having me on. This is always fun. And, the genesis for this was you and I were just chatting on the phone. And I'm like, hey, why don't we record this?
Yep.
So I think we could do this every day for the rest of our lives. And
never get down to the bedrock issues of what's really important in life here. No.
Thanks, Bryce.
This is what's important, everybody.
A lot of fun, man. Have a good one.
All right. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.